Over shots of children playing intercut with old footage of Jewish children in ghettos, a man speaks to the camera.
You know how many children survive? Just a few survive.
More footage of children in ghettos. Narration begins.
Hitler and the Nazis planned to murder every Jewish child in Europe.
Kids. We were kids.
I was quite a cookie. I think I was a wild little girl.
Children don't die. Old people die.
As many as 1.5 million children perished in the Holocaust. But Maxwell, Helen, and Rose survived.
There were 7 dead bodies, red blood on the snow.
2 guards grabbed my brother and took him away.
And these holes were made by bullets.
He was only, I think, 5 years old.
Why do people kill little children? How can it be possible?
Today, they are among the last survivors and have lived a lifetime with unanswered questions.
I have no idea what happened to the baby. It would be nice to know what happened.
So where did you separate from your dad?
Right here. They took them away with trucks. Where could they have taken them?
We found Rifa's brother.
What are you telling me here?
75 years after the end of the Second World War, these children who survived the Holocaust are about to make some remarkable discoveries.
You mean it's a possibility? Shut up.
Oh my God, this is like a dream.
She must have been holding my little brother in her arms in the gas chambers and thinking that she cheated them of one. Me. She cheated Hitler of a child.
Title reads, Cheating Hitler, Surviving the Holocaust. An overhead shot of a woman walking a long path within a field. Fade to black. Title reads, Maxwell.
I came here to tell you a story that really happened. I kept this story of mine hidden for 60 years. I didn't tell it to anybody. I didn't want to relive the horror of my life.
Maxwell writes his name on a small chalkboard.
My name is Maxwell Smart. I was born in 1930 in Poland, Buchach.
Text reads, Buchach, Ukraine, formerly Poland. Jewish population before the war, 8,000.
From 8,000 Jews in Buchach, only 100 survived. Only 100. I am one of 100.
Old footage of Jewish people fleeing.
2 years into World War II, in June 1941, the Nazis invade Soviet-occupied eastern Poland and rapidly advance towards Maxwell's home city. At this point, the Nazis are systematically rounding up and persecuting Jews.
Old footage of Nazi soldiers is shown.
Within days of the Nazi occupation of Buchach, Maxwell's father is taken away and never seen again. And then, in a series of roundups in early 1943, 12-year-old Maxwell, his mother, and little sister are forced towards waiting trucks.
I'm walking with my mother, my sister's in her arms. She says, you have to run away? What do you mean, run away? Where am I going to run? You're my mother. You're supposed to protect me. I can't protect you. I can't help you.
An animation depicts Maxwell's story.
Please, Risa, walk away from the trolley. All of a sudden, I am not in the circle of the trucks. I'm on the bridge, walking towards freedom. And I never saw my mother, my sister, again.
Where do you think the trucks went with your mother and your sister?
What are they going to do with children? They can't go to labor camps. They went to Federal. I didn't hear shooting because it's probably done later on. I don't know if the graves were dug or the graves were prepared. I have no idea. I have no answers. Because nobody could tell me anything about it. Nobody was there.
Evidence of what happened to Maxwell's mother and sister can be found on a wooded hill on the edge of Puchach. There are very few records of the murders that took place here nearly 80 years ago. But now, a team of investigators is trying to piece together the crime. And they have found a witness. Someone who saw it with their own eyes.
The eyewitness Regina speaks. First, there were only women, then later only men. The translator asks, were they solely women brought, or maybe with children? The witness responds, with children. She goes on to explain, they brought them to a pit, and the pit had already been dug, and the Jews climbed down one by one into the pit and were shot. Investigator Patrice speaks to the camera.
We have been working for now 15 years on the so-called Holocaust by bullets by interviewing what we call the bystanders, so non-Jewish witnesses of the shooting of the Jews here.
Patrice and his team at Yachad and Unum identify and investigate Holocaust execution sites. And it's the testimonies of women like Regina that reveal the true horror.
Regina continues to speak and says, one of the women got into the pit and said, you think that when you kill us, then you will win? You will lose in the end. The translator nods, then turns to the researchers.
She was already in the pit, she told that, and after that she was shot.
Regina looks solemn. Cut to old footage.
Jews were brought to woods and ravines and killed one by one in mass shootings. This wasn't the Holocaust of camps and gas chambers. This was the Holocaust in bullets.
Shown is an old photograph of Jewish men kneeling before a pit.
And the children were also shot, or they were just thrown alive?
Regina answers Patrice, saying, the children were taken aside separately, and then all the little children were shot at the end. I saw the pit.
What we try to do going in the field is to understand how the killers implement the crime. And on the sites, what we do is kind of rebuilding the crime scenes.
Could this be the place where Maxwell's mother and sister were brought, just hours after he escaped? Patrice is doing a forensic examination of the site, searching for any actual physical evidence of the massacres.
Fellow investigator Vasil finds a bullet shell and hands it to Patrice, telling him to look for the date.
So it's a German cartridge from 39. I think like in 15 minutes we found about four cartridges, so it's not that difficult to find evidence.
Vasil finds an old pocket mirror.
So we found before cartridges and now we just found a mirror. So we believe it was something that belonged to one of the victims because we believe that they were shooting from here and the Jews were down below. I think that the sister of Maxwell and his mother were killed here. We have like at least three or four mass graves here that where you have at least 5,000 people from Buchach, and the bodies are still here.
Text reads Fedor Hill killing site, 5,000 Jews murdered.
So far, Patrice and his team have documented more than 2,800 such sites all over Eastern Europe.
That's the story of my mother. She refused to take me with her, and by refusing, I live today.
Young Maxwell escapes the mass killings on Fedor Hill. But with nowhere else to turn, he ends up in these forests. A 12-year-old boy with no family, alone, in hiding.
About 6 months, I was by myself, alone in the woods. My clothing was gone, ripped to pieces. My shoes were gone. I used racks on my feet, tied up with strings. I was lying in a hole.
Maxwell's story becomes animated.
I became like a sort of animal, a human animal. In my whole life, I can never, till today, forget the misery of being alone.
Fade to black on Maxwell. Text reads, Rose.
I think I was a wild little girl. Didn't sit still for a minute. Had very long, curly, blonde hair. My mother used to put them in braids. But, you know, me running around, the braids went loose and I went loose.
Contemporary footage of children playing. Rose writes her name on a chalkboard.
My name was Ruja Handelsman as a child. And I was born in Lublin, Poland in 1929, May the 27th. Well, that gets me to be of age.
Rose smiles warmly. Then, a chalk animation of the map of Europe, Lublin, Poland, is outlined.
A lot of my days were spent on the sidewalks playing hopscotch. My mother didn't like it too much. All my shoes went to hopscotch. Oh gosh, I must have been quite a cookie.
Rose nods to herself.
Rose grew up on Grodzka Street, in the once vibrant Jewish quarter of Lublin.
Rose approaches a hotel.
80 years later, she's returning to her family home with her granddaughters.
And I remember those are the windows of our home. That's where we lived and that's where my father worked. And now it's such a fancy place, beautiful hotel.
Rose puts her hand to her heart.
Oh my God.
Did people live up there? Like there was more?
Oh yes, the people lived there. I remember they all used to come to our apartment to talk to my mother because my mother liked politics and they knew what was happening in Germany. I guess my mother said if we had the money, we would run from here. But we didn't have the money to do that. So we didn't run. So we stayed.
Exterior shot of Lublin. Text reads, Jews deported by the Nazis, 40,000. Survival rate, less than 1%. Shown is an old photograph of Rose and her family.
Rose has a single photograph that shows her entire family. Out of 21 relatives, parents, siblings, aunts, uncles, and cousins, only two would survive.
It brings back those memories of my childhood that you never want to forget, really. I had a little brother. His name was Henik.
A little boy is shown.
Oh, I used to carry him around. I loved him so much. My father was a tailor. What a gentle soul he was. He really was. And my mother was quite a bright woman. I always thought they were going to keep me safe. Because parents are supposed to keep the children safe.
Rose frowns and looks away. Cut to old footage of Nazi roundups.
In a scene repeated countless times across Poland, the Nazis rounded up Rose, her mother, father, and brothers, together with thousands of other Jews, in this market square outside of Lublin.
The market square is shown. A crow flies from a tree. Rose walks around a center fountain.
Oh my God. This...
It's the first time Rose has been back.
Is that the place?
Since October 14th, 1942.
Rose slowly walks with her hands to her chin.
There were so many people here. Oh my God, they were just people carrying their bags. And then they started dividing us. Men and women here. Children and women here.
Old footage of the roundups continue.
And then when they divided, came trucks and they took the men away.
Footage of a Jewish man being pushed away by a Nazi. Rose meets her granddaughters.
I'm afraid I'm not going to sleep tonight. I don't know, the nightmares might come back. I had a lot of them many years. I remember some nightmares that I was running from the Germans, but I was running with my children. Like, it never goes away completely. It's always there.
So where did you separate from your dad?
Right here. They took them away with trucks.
Did you have a chance to say bye to him?
No, I don't remember.
Didn't you think you were going to see him again?
No.
Where did you guys think you were going?
I don't know. They're settling us, like they always said. They're settling you.
Rose's granddaughters are teary-eyed.
This is the last place Rose and her mother would ever see her father.
An old photo of Rose's father is shown.
They took my father away with the truck. And somebody that told me they took him to Majdanek, the concentration camp Majdanek.
This is the only snippet of information Rose has ever had about what happened to her father. Now she wants to find out if it's true.
Rose walks along barbed wire fence. Next reads, Maxwell.
I used to have long, long discussions with God. I used to tell him, look at me, I say. I don't wash myself for months. I say, I drink water with my dirty hand like an animal. Why did you create me to be a Jew?
Overhead footage of the lush Berem Yaanai forest.
In 1943, after his mother and sister are murdered by the Nazis, 12-year-old Maxwell flees to this forest and digs himself a hole to hide in. Today, investigators are looking for that hiding place.
Vasil and Patrice survey a map.
Maxwell was hiding not far away from Zhny Borody. Bogdan, a local hunter, will show us the way to bunkers he has encountered several times when he was hunting in this forest.
Bogdan brings the two through the forest.
I didn't build this hole. It was just a natural rock hangover from the mountain. I dug it a little bit out to make it a little bit deeper. I covered the front with some branches, not to be too much visible. And that was my place of hiding.
Vasil carries his metal detector with him. The group continues through the forest.
Bogdan leads Patrice to a hiding place he believes dates back to World War II.
The group reaches a small hole under a rock formation similar to the way Maxwell described.
It fits with the description of the mountain and the fact that the entrance was quite close to the ground.
A night vision camera enters the hole.
It could have been dug with shovel, done with very basic tools, like Maxwell described.
Once again, Maxwell's story is animated.
One day, I heard a noise, not a familiar noise. All of a sudden, I see a little boy walking in the woods. I walk out, I stop him. I asked him, are you Jewish? He says, yes. And I told him, I'm Jewish too. Who are you? What are you doing here? I asked him. And he tells me the story, what happened. He is in hiding about a year and a half. One day his mother disappeared. She went to find food. She never came back. His father went out to find food. And he never came back. I'm walking, he says, for 2 days. And I'm so happy, he says, I found you. He was a good-looking kid, mind you. Smart. He was excellent in arithmetic. His name was Yannick. I was the first time really, really happy. I didn't care if he would stay in the woods for a year or two. I had a friend.
In real time, Vasil uses his metal detector around the hiding place.
These forests were by no means safe. Ukrainian police and peasants hunted Jews here in return for sugar and vodka from the Nazis. For Patrice and his team, this entire area is a crime scene that needs to be thoroughly swept.
Vasil finds another bullet casing. It's from the 1940s.
Yeah, the year of production is 40, so wartime. So a German cartridge from 1940.
A photographer takes photos of the shell.
We have traces of the perpetrators. It's clear that there were some shootings here, so it could be shooting of Jews who were hiding here. the killers didn't expect that people would come back and look for the evidence of that crime.
Janek was my friend, but he didn't survive the war. I still feel responsible. Because of me, Janek died.
Maxwell looks disheartened. Fade to black. Text reads, Helen.
We played hopscotch or hide and seek and whatever. Kids. We were kids. My full name is Chaya Verblunskaitė.
Helen writes her name in chalk.
I was born in Lithuania. I was born in the city that was the capital city in those days, by the name of Kaunas or Kovno.
A chalk animation of the map of Europe. Kaunas, Lithuania is outlined. Cut to an establishing shot of the Lithuanian city. Text reads, Kaunas, also known as Kovno, Lithuania. Jewish population before the war, 35,000. Jews murdered, 33,000.
Chaya, who now calls herself Helen, was just 10 when the Nazis occupied her city of Kovno and forced the entire Jewish population into an enclosed district called a ghetto. Subjected to overcrowding, hunger, and disease, Jews were forced into slave labor and children forbidden from going to school.
Old photographs of Jewish children in the ghettos are shown.
Helen lived in the ghetto for 3 years with her parents and little brother.
Little Abraham Avremele in Yiddish. I was the one who took a look after him when the ghetto started.
These rare photos are of Jewish children in the Kovno ghetto. The Nazis called them useless eaters, too young to work. They were the future of the Jewish race. They were the enemy.
A photograph of Jewish children who are still smiling in the ghettos, then a photo of young Helen.
I was here probably between 10 and 11. My biggest regret of this photo is that I didn't have my brother at my side at that time. That would have been a perfect thing.
Why would that have been perfect?
Because there is no picture of my brother. There's nothing that he ever existed.
On the morning of March 27th, 1944, just after most of the Jewish parents had left for forced labor, trucks full of soldiers rolled into the Kovno ghetto. They had orders to seize all the children. They called it a Kinder action.
There are trucks, there are dogs, there are soldiers with guns. You'd think we're the worst enemies. And people are told to get on the truck, and people go. Mothers with kids. And I'm standing with my brother's back to me. And I hear them, let them go. The dog jumped on my wrist and bit me. The blood spurted out, and inadvertently, I let him go. Two guards came and grabbed my brother and took him away. One thing, and I never let this go, my brother was turning his head when he was dragged away. His head was looking whether I was following. I wouldn't be sitting here if I would be following.
For some reason, the Nazis did not take Helen that day, but they seized around 1,300 children. Loud music was played to drown out the screams. They were never seen again. Helen has not been back to Lithuania since 1944. She has vowed never to return. But there are unanswered questions that she has lived with for 75 years.
There are places that I would have liked to visit, but I just couldn't make myself go. But my grandson, Andrew, took it upon himself to represent me to places where I dare not go.
Andrew peers into an old World War II era building.
The guilt about losing her brother is on my grandmother's shoulders, and it has been since the day he was taken. And I think that last look of him being taken away has been on her mind, and it will be for the rest of her life.
Andrew walks to an old fort just outside of the city.
I think we need to know where he was taken, because that, I think, for her might be not closure, but at least be able to know what happened for sure.
The only reason why he was killed was because he was a little Jewish boy. I have no idea where my little brother Abraham was taken to die.
Fade to black on Helen. Text reads, Helen.
Whom did I lose? My brother, little Abraham, Avramele.
Shown, an old photograph of Helen and her classmates.
Friends that will never grow up and become anything they wanted. I feel very isolated because I am here and they're not.
Helen's little brother Avram was taken from her arms in a kinder action in the Kovno ghetto in 1944. Now her grandson Andrew has returned to Lithuania to find out what happened. He wants to know if little Avram could have been brought here. The ninth fort outside Kaunas. On these fields, thousands and thousands of Jews were murdered.
An overhead shot of the ninth fort and its Holocaust monument. Text reads, occupied by Nazis from 1941 to 1944, prison and extermination camp. The museum director speaks to Andrew.
When Kaunas ghetto was established in 1941, there were 30,000 of Kaunas Jews and the Jews of Kaunas region. And survived only 500 of them.
500.
About 500 in 1944. Most, they were killed here during these 3 years.
So how did the Nazis decide, like, who was coming to the ninth fort?
Because, you know, Nazis used Jewish population forced labor, you know, strong people who can work, and the older ones, and also children, they were selected to be killed.
A handful of disturbing photographs of the killing operations here exist, and very few documents detailing the murders. The only physical evidence of the victims are a few artifacts pulled out of the ground, including a toy bucket and a child's shoe.
It's really difficult to think that Nazis killed young children. They killed babies. It's really difficult. You can see now that wall. Also, you see these holes. And these holes were made by bullets. And probably a lot of people, they were standing.
They were standing right here.
The executors stood over there. That view probably was the last one for a lot of people.
That's really haunting to be standing here, because over 70 years ago, I would have been next.
The two observe the bullet-riddled wall.
So if Kinder Action victims were brought to the ninth fort, where would they have been killed?
It's a possibility that they were killed here.
At this wall?
Yeah.
It just strikes me that I'm standing here right now, and it could have been the place where little Abraham was killed.
The two stand in silence by the wall and are at a loss for words. Andrew sighs.
I'm a little bit overwhelmed, to be honest, in thinking about how he was only, I think, 5 years old, maybe six, but I think he was five, and he was brought here without his sister, without his parents, and marched into this fort by himself and just, like, shot to death just because he was not useful to the Nazis.
Andrew shakes his head and closes his eyes for a moment. He turns and looks at the wall again, but can't seem to find the right words to say. He then recoils and looks away from the wall.
I can't. I don't know.
Another overhead shot of the fort. Above the bullet-riddled wall, a sign reads, "There, near this wall, Nazis shot and burned people in 1943 to 1944.
More than 90% of Jewish children were killed in Nazi-occupied Europe. Avram was one of them. But his sister's story of survival had only just begun.
For years, I was wondering, why me? What did I do to deserve to be alive? This is with me for the rest of my life.
Fade to black on Helen. Text reads, Maxwell.
I was talking to God. He listened to me. Maybe he did send me, Yannick.
Cut to a snowy forest.
Late 1943, two friends, Maxwell and Yannick, were hiding in the woods outside Buchach. They were being hunted by local Ukrainians employed by the Nazis to find Jews.
One day, we heard shooting. We heard yelling. We heard commotion. When it got quiet, I said, Yannick, should we see what happened? I don't know, he says. I'm scared. I don't want to go anyplace. I says, Yannick, we have to go and take a look. At least let's peek. Okay. Maybe 500 feet away from our bunker, we saw a sight unforgettable.
Animated dead bodies are shown.
There were 7 bodies in one place. Red blood on the snow. We go into the first body, dead. The second body, dead. We checked all the bodies, all dead people. We look around, and across the river, I see a body lying. I say, Yannick, there's somebody across. She's moving. Yeah. Yannick, we have to go over and see. No, he says, I cannot go over and see. I'm not going to go into the cold water. But Yannick, this person is alive. I grab Yannick by his hand and I pull him into the cold water. I don't want to go. We cross the river outside. It's freezing. We come over to the body. The body wasn't moving. The body was a mother holding a baby in her arm. The mother was dead. She was shot in the back. And the baby started to move. I grab the baby. I take Yannick and we go to the other side. As soon as I touch the baby starts yelling and crying. And we went into the bunker and she's crying. So what do we do, Yannick? You see, he says, you see. He was shivering from the cold. He was wet. He started to cry.
Two young boys have saved a baby, but its crying puts them in danger of discovery. Maxwell finds a Jewish family hiding nearby. Miraculously, one of the women is the baby's aunt. She takes her niece, and Maxwell never sees her or the child again. Back in the bunker, Maxwell's friend Yannick has fallen ill.
Yannick was sick and he didn't feel good because I pulled him into that water. I figure maybe he will revive. I don't know. Yannick is not moving. He is dead. He died. He was my life. He was my person that I needed till today. I cannot forget Yannick. Janek. It's a name. It's a name and a boy who stayed with me for 6 months. What else is there about him?
Fade to black on Maxwell Street's Rose.
I remember my father always singing while he was working. I still remember. Like Kinderjul. Shane Kinderjul. He used to sing that song always while he was working. That's the memory of father.
Cut to the exterior of Majdanek.
Rose's father was taken away on a truck in 1942. And Rose believes he may have been brought here, to Majdanek. Built in the suburbs of Lublin, Majdanek could hold up to 45,000 Polish and Jewish prisoners at a time. Rose wants to know if her father was one of them, and she hopes Jakub, a researcher here, can give her the information she needs.
That's why I'm here. I want to know anything what happened in that time.
Jakub tells Rose, if your father came here in mid-October 1942 to Majdanek, the conditions prevailing in the camp were tragic. Then, footage of Jews behind barbed wire fence is shown. Inside the barracks, Jakub continues. In each of these barracks, at peak times, when there was a large transport, several hundreds of people lived here. That's a lot.
So they must have slept one on top of the other, practically.
Rose points into the barracks. There are triple-stacked bunk beds.
Majdanek functioned as part of Operation Reinhardt, the secret Nazi plan to eliminate Poland's Jews and to profit from their murder by seizing their valuables and personal possessions. It became a major storage and sorting depot for these looted goods.
Rose says to Jakub, my father was a tailor. Do you think he worked somewhere here as a tailor or no? Jakub responds, it is possible that your father worked here as a tailor in one of the barracks. There was probably one barrack that was designated for tailors who not just sewed but repaired clothing that had been looted from the Jews. Rose nods. Then, footage of a Jewish tailor.
Tailors were useful to the Nazis. Not only did they mend these looted clothes destined for Germany, but they were forced to search for valuables hidden in the linings and seams. His skills as a tailor may have kept Rose's father alive.
Laser Handelsmann was his name.
Yeah, we don't
know anything.
Any.
So you don't have any documents that my father was here at any time?
We don't have any documents.
Cut to footage of Jews in the camps.
By November 1943, Operation Reinhardt had come to an end, with the death of nearly 2 million Polish Jews. With no more loot to be seized, the workers at Majdanek were no longer needed.
All the Jews which were prisoners at the Majdanek were killed during the Action Erntefest. Executed.
Text reads, Action Erntefest, Operation Harvest Festival, November 3rd, 1943, over 18,000 Jews killed.
Jews were shot one by one in large pits at the perimeter of the camp. Music was played through loudspeakers to mask the noise. The slaughter of more than 18,000 was completed in just one day.
Rose and her granddaughters enter a barn inside of the camp. It is filled with old shoes.
These are all shoes, all the way down. Shoes.
Oh my God. This is unbelievable.
Multiple cages filled with thousands of shoes stretched down the barn.
Oh my God.
Rose puts her face into the shoulder of her granddaughter. Then, an old photo of Jews with their hands above their heads.
It is believed that this photograph shows the thousands of Jewish inmates at Majdanek marching to their death. Rose's father may have been one of them. But what happened to her mother and brothers?
She looked me straight in the face. I want you to understand I was 13 years old at the time. And she said, they're taking us to our death. That was her conclusion.
Text reads, Helen.
We knew about the concentration camp gas chambers. We knew that there is such a thing.
A chalk animation of Nazis taking Avram away.
4 months after Helen's little brother Avram was snatched from her arms in the Kinder Action, the Nazis closed the Kovno ghetto. Along with thousands of other Jews, Helen and her parents were loaded into cattle cars and deported west.
We didn't know where we were going or what was happening to us.
Cut to a bird's eye view of an overgrown Nazi railway.
Finally, it stopped, and we were able to get ourselves out of the train. But that is when I lost my father.
Helen's father was sent to Dachau concentration camp and never seen again. Helen and her mother were sent to Stutthof.
Text reads, Stutthof, 28,000 Jews killed.
She was just 11 years old when she arrived. She was taken with her mother into a room full of pipes and shower heads.
Old footage of a gas chamber.
My mother and I were standing there waiting, and we are both naked, standing holding each other.
Old footage of a sign reads, bath and disinfection.
And I remember shower heads over our head. And after a few minutes, water came out. So here I am sitting, talking to you. I can't explain this, but I was there for the taking.
According to Nazi procedure, as an 11-year-old child, Helen should have been killed in this gas chamber. So how did she cheat death when thousands of others did not?
Andrew is now at Stutthof.
Helen's grandson, Andrew, has come to meet Danuta, a researcher at the Stutthof archives, to find out.
Danuta and Andrew look at old Nazi records.
This is the original card.
This is the original document.
That's the original card.
And there's her number, so 43971. I wonder if she remembers that was her number. So it says here that she was born in 1927, but I know that wasn't her birthday.
Okay.
I know that she was born 5 years later. So why did they do that to her age?
They decided to change the dates because if someone was too young and they add some years, it was high possibility that this person would be able to survive in the camp.
So my grandmother is reporting that she's 17, but actually she's just 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
So if she was unlucky enough to look younger than she was, she may have been sent right to her death. This little birthday change here may have been one of the many things, but one of the most important parts of her story that kept her alive.
Helen and her mother were deemed fit for work and shipped out to Stutthof's network of sub-camps.
I was doing heavy labor. We were digging trenches every single day from morning till night. I mean, we had a dark life, I can assure you.
A shot of a Nazi guard tower at Stutthof.
But that was around the time that I met Riva and her mother, Mrs. Rubin. Riva was from the same ghetto as I was, the Kovno ghetto. We were the same age, we had the same history. We both had little brothers and we would chat about them. We had each other, she had me and I had her. We become as close as a family can be.
In the 75 years since Helen was at Stutthof, she has never forgotten her friend Riva, another little girl from her hometown, caught up in the horrors of the Holocaust.
My grandmother talks about a friend that she made in the subcamp, and her name was Riva, and she always wanted to know more information about her. I think her last name is Rubin.
The archivist says Riva Rubin's documents have also survived. She takes a card out and says, this card is similar to your grandmother's.
They came in on the same day, didn't they?
Yes, they were together. They were together.
And both from Kaunas. Do you see this? She signed her name.
Yeah.
It looks like a kid's signature that just learned how to write cursive writing. My gosh. She was just a kid. These are the cards of two best friends that went through the Holocaust together, and today this is as close as it can get to having Riva back for my grandmother.
I made a friend, but unfortunately, this friend did not survive.
Helen stops and thinks to herself. Fade to black. Text reads, Maxwell.
I still feel responsible. If I wouldn't save the baby, Yannick would have been alive with me today.
Maxwell wants to know if there is any other living person who remembers his friend Yannick. So he's flying out to the one place where it might just be possible to find out.
This is my destination, to go to Israel and to clear my conscience, at least in one part.
He has come to the Hall of Names at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. Researchers here have taken on a colossal task, attempting to name every single Jewish victim of the Holocaust.
We are in the Hall of Names.
Yeah.
What you see here are pages of testimony and photographs of victims of the Holocaust.
These binders hold names of close to 5 million victims identified by family members.
In each one, there are 300 pages of testimony.
300 pages?
Yes.
We still don't know the names of more than a million victims, many of them children. Yad Vashem is on a mission to identify them all. And their database offers an incredible resource for Maxwell to find out more about Yannick and his family.
During the Holocaust, I was hiding with a boy. I know his name is Yannick, this is for sure.
Where were you at the time? In what place?
In the Buchach area, maybe 15 miles away.
Okay, so let's try to see if we can find something. We have Yannick and
Yannick.
We'll try Buchach.
Aronov, Aron's son.
So we have a Yaakov Yannick,
Yannick, Yannick.
And he was from the
also from Buchach.
Okay, so let's see what we get here. So we'll go into details. Okay, this is what we call a page of testimony. Is a declaration of somebody who knew the victim, and they register here all the information they know about the victim. For Yannick Arenberg, he was born in Zlochov, it's in the area, used to live in Buchach,
right?
And he, according to this, he was born in 1931.
1931. Something. Yeah, I remember I was older than him.
Huh? What do you think about the photograph?
I'm telling you, he looked like that. Mm-hmm. This, the eyes, the eyes tell me that this is Yannick.
Mm-hmm. The expression of the eyes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The expression. You know why? He always looked at me sad. Very sad. He's a sad kid.
Well, he had a sad story.
Yeah.
Haunted for nearly 80 years by the death of his friend, Maxwell has finally found a testimony filed by someone who knew Yannick.
So what we have here is Shimon Shiferis, who was the nephew of this person.
Oh, he's the uncle of Yannick.
Mm-hmm. Here we have an address in Israel, in Givat Haim.
There is an address.
Yes.
So this makes sense. Yes. I would like to speak to this man.
Okay, so we'll try to do it.
Maxwell stares at the computer screen, fade to black. Text reads, Helen.
You said your friend Riva died. Were you there?
Oh, yes. I was there when Riva died. And I was lying right beside her when she passed away.
Helen and her best friend Riva had managed to survive Stutthof work camps until the very last stages of the war. In January 1945, as the Soviet army advanced on Poland, the Nazis began evacuating the camps. They either forced the surviving Jews to walk to Germany in what became known as death marches, or they were executed in their camps. Helen, Riva, and their mothers were selected for immediate death.
We were told to come in and lie down on the bare floor. And we were told not to move. And that very same afternoon, we were injected with some substance that to this day I have no idea what it was. I was thinking that this is the end of us, that this is finished. We are not surviving anymore.
Chalk animation of a Nazi doctor injecting the drug.
But Helen did survive. So what was in those injections? Her grandson Andrew is in Stutthof to see if he can find out.
So my grandmother remembers being injected with something. Do you have any idea what that could have been?
It was the fentanyl injection, which was used to kill the people, to kill the prisoners. And there was a story happened in the subcamp where your grandmother was. The doctor, she was the Hungarian doctor, and she was also the prisoner. She was forced by the assessment to make an injection. But she gave them the smaller dose of the injection, so that she was hoping that they would be able to survive.
Really?
Yes.
The full dose of the poison didn't go into them.
That's why they survived.
And that might be part of the story that she's missing. That really explains why she's here today.
Yes.
Andrew half smiles.
Helen and her mother did survive, but Riva and her mother did not. They both died weeks after the Russians liberated the camp. Helen has never forgotten something Riva told her before she died.
She told me that she had a little brother. I don't know his name. Riva told me that he was given away to a non-Jewish family for safety reasons.
Many Jewish parents gave their children to Christian families in the hope that they would survive the Holocaust. Thousands of hidden children never saw their families again.
I know what happened to Riva, but I don't know what happened to her little brother. And I wonder about that. To this day, I have no idea if anybody survived to take him, claim him back. Where is he now and who raised him?
Here at Yad Vashem, there is a way to search for people who died in the Holocaust, and perhaps even trace any living relatives. Dr. Abraham is scouring the database of 4.8 million victims' names to see if there are any matches for Riva.
So we actually have one Rivka Rubin from Kovno. She was born in 1931. It is written that she died in the area of Stutthof. Let's go into details. So it's a page of testimony in Hebrew that was submitted in 1999.
Someone submitted this testimony about Riva and included a photo taken several years before the war.
The page of testimony was reported by one Elhanan Rubin, and he apparently is her brother, Rivka's brother.
Dr. Abraham looks at the data entry.
Do you recognize this girl?
Helen is handed the documents on Riva. She takes a look at them.
Oh my God, I don't know.
Do you recognize this woman?
She is handed a photograph.
Is there a name here? Rubinovich. Would that be... You're talking about Mrs. Rubin? You mean that this could be Riva? Oh my God, I'm not... It's blowing me away. So this is my Riva. What a beautiful girl.
Helen stares at the photograph.
She looks like she's a princess. Beautiful and not lacking for anything. I wish I'd known her before the war.
So we found Riva's brother.
Helen's eyes open wide.
Oh, what are you telling me here? Oh my God, what miracle, how is that? That the mother died and she died? Oh, would I like to meet this man? Oh my God.
Helen looks almost euphoric. Cut to an establishing shot of Toronto, Canada on a bright and sunny day.
Having lost her own brother to the Holocaust, Helen has wondered about Riva's little brother her entire life. Since he was a boy, this man has been searching for someone who knew his sister and has traveled from Israel for this moment. Now, after 75 years,
they're knocking the door.
They finally get to meet.
Riva's brother, Elkanan, knocks and enters Rose's apartment. They finally meet face to face. They embrace each other with little hesitation.
Oh, very nice to meet you.
Same here. Oh my God, this is like a dream. Yes, your mother and your sister upstairs in heaven are looking down, smiling.
Yes.
Hello.
This is my son, Menachem.
Nice to meet you. I worried a lot about you for coming all this way.
I'm very
happy to hear all these stories.
Yes.
We don't have any information, so you're the last chance.
I'm the last chance.
Cut back to Helen being interviewed.
Does he deserve to know the whole story, how they died? There'll be questions, very difficult questions.
Fade to black on Helen. Text reads, Maxwell.
Yannick is actually a hero. He did a very great thing. He saved a child. Just imagine.
Over 75 years ago, Maxwell's friend Yannick died after they rescued a baby during World War II. Maxwell has just found out that Yannick has a surviving uncle in Tel Aviv.
I didn't know that Yannick had any family left. I never knew. We never discussed it. But I'm very excited to meet anybody of Yannick's family.
The family don't know how Yannick died. Maxwell plans to tell them the truth.
By saving the baby, Yannick sacrificed himself. He became a hero in my eyes. I would like to tell that to his uncle.
So we're here.
We're here.
You're here, Maxwell. You've been waiting for this a long time, my husband. Here we are. Mary?
Hi, Mary. My God. Oh, my God.
Oh.
Was I happy when I saw you?
Maxwell embraces Yannick's cousin, Mary. Inside are Yannick's aunt and uncle.
This is Yannick's aunt?
Yes. Abba.
Yannick's uncle is in a wheelchair and has hearing aids. Maxwell mentions Yannick's name, and Yannick's uncle becomes attentive. Maxwell explains that he was the one that found him in the forest. Maxwell asks who submitted Yannick to Yad Vashem. Yannick's uncle says that it was him. Yannick's aunt walks over to Maxwell and kisses him on the cheek. She then wipes the side of his face.
Thank you.
She sits down beside Maxwell and asks him to tell the story of what happened. Maxwell says, I gave him food, I gave him clothes, I gave him everything. Yannick's aunt then holds Maxwell's face and says thank you. Maxwell begins to cry as he says, I found him. Yannick's aunt cries and thanks Maxwell for what he did for Yannick. Maxwell says, I found him. He was wandering alone in the forest. He wanted to eat, but he didn't have any food. Maxwell is choking up while he's telling the story. He holds both of Yannick's aunt's hands. Yannick's aunt says, he had a good time with you. He had a friend. He had a protector. Maxwell earnestly says, he was the best thing that God gave me. The best thing, because finally I wasn't alone. Then, Yannick's aunt asks how Yannick died.
On Umar.
Maxwell then points to himself and says he died because of me. Yannick's aunt asks how. Maxwell replies, he froze.
For the first time, Maxwell tells Yannick's aunt the story of how he died after saving the baby girl by the river.
Maxwell says, that's how Yannick died. Yannick's aunt leans in and says, at least he died peacefully. Maxwell responds, and you know why? He died because he went into the frozen water with me, and we saved that girl. This girl is Yannick's. Yannick gave her a new life. Yannick's aunt nods and leans back. Then, Yannick's cousin, Miri, brings over old photographs of their family.
I want to show you. This is the picture of the family. Ruja, Rachel, mother of Yannick, her husband, Moshe Ehrenberg, Heinek, and Yannick.
All my life, I felt responsible for his death. I felt responsible for his death. I pulled them in. You maybe don't understand.
Yannick's aunt tells Maxwell not to think like that. Maxwell cries out, I've been thinking like that all my life. Yannick's aunt says, you shouldn't.
I am happy you are with us and telling us the story. For me, Yannick became alive. He is now part of my life.
As a person.
And he's with me from now. Before, it was just a name. And now, I feel...
He's a human being.
Yes. And...
It's our kid.
Maxwell consoles Mary.
I'm happy.
It's, you're happy, and you're crying, you're happy. And I'm crying too, you're happy.
Maxwell smiles with tears of joy. He looks around the room. Fade to black. Text reads, Rose.
We were walking, my little brother, my mother, and I. It was a shining, beautiful day. And when they started walking on that road, she said, that's the last day on earth, and I intend to take the sunshine in.
Old footage plays of thousands of Jews carrying their belongings over a bridge.
After being separated from her father, Rose, together with her mother and brothers, and thousands of other women and children, were marched along this road. This is the first time Rose has ever been back.
You see, that's the road that I walked blessed with my mother and my two brothers. 3,000 people were walking, all of us together.
So all the children were walking.
Children were walking, and the women were walking and carrying the bags.
And if they were kind of trying to step out of line, what would happen?
There were guards on both sides with guns.
Where do you think everyone was going?
To the train station. That was the road that was going to the nearest train station.
Rose and her granddaughters walked down the same path she did so many years ago.
There were 3,000 people on that road that day.
Chalk animation accompanies her story.
That's what I remember about the crowd the most. People carrying those big bags, really thinking that they're going to be resettled somewhere else. My mother started holding back and holding back and holding back. She grabbed whatever I carried and threw it away. She looked me straight in the face. I want you to understand I was 13 years old at the time. And she said, they're taking us to our death. That was her conclusion. She looked life straight in the face. She looked at me and she says, you have to run. I can't run with you because I cannot leave that little boy alone. And with him, none of us have a chance. I don't believe the whole world has gone mad. There is going to be somebody somewhere that's going to help you. And you will survive. And if you survive, so will I, through you.
The animation of Rose's mother slowly disappears.
You see, at first I didn't want to go. I was holding on to her skirt so tightly because I didn't want to go. I didn't want to leave my mother or my brother. That's the last time I saw her. I didn't even say goodbye. She pushed me forcibly off the road.
I just think about, like, for me personally, my kids, and, like, I don't know how your mom had the strength to do that. And how you, as a child, like, were able to...
Rose's oldest granddaughter begins to cry. Rose looks at her softly and gives her a hug.
No, she's my oldest granddaughter. And she looks a little like my mother.
An old photograph of Rose's mother is shown. The resemblance is remarkable.
And that's when I started running through the fields. Never saw my mother again or my brother again. That was the last time I saw.
Rose ran 15 kilometers to the house of the Jablonskis, Polish farmers who gave her refuge and a new identity.
An old photograph of two smiling farmers.
And I slept the night on the attic. You could see through the holes. I remember looking out, hoping maybe my mother escaped too, and she's going to come walking down that road.
Cut to old footage of Jews boarding the Nazi trains.
But Rose's mother and brother were already being loaded onto boxcars at this station.
An old station and railway crossing is shown.
As part of Operation Reinhardt, the Nazis had constructed extermination centers, away from centers of population and hidden far from prying eyes, deep in the forests of eastern Poland.
They went to Sobibor on October the 14th. That's the day the 3,000 people wound up in Sobibor. That's how I know.
Sobibor is marked on a chalk map.
Rose is now following her mother's final journey to Sobibor.
They brought them in the wilderness. I wonder if there is a station. I don't know.
There's train tracks right there.
There is train tracks? Yeah. You see? So they must have brought them, directly.
Oh my God. Look on the left. Looks like the train station, the old train station that says Sobibor.
There's a train station.
Give her a second.
At the sight of the train station, Rose breaks down and cries, putting her hand to her face. Fade to black. Text reads, Helen.
And what do you know about Reva's family?
Precious little, except that this brother of hers was given away.
He doesn't know how they died.
He doesn't know how they died, eh? Should he not know it? What do you think?
Maybe he needs to. I don't know.
He needs to know, you think?
Like my sister.
Yes.
The same age. It's very, very nice.
Helen has just met Elchanan Rubin for the first time. He is the little brother of Reva, the friend she lost 75 years ago at Stutthof concentration camp. Elchanan was just 6 when his mother and sister left him with a Christian family before being deported to the camp.
In 1945, the war is over, and all the people have to come back. So nobody come to me.
Yeah, nobody come to claim you. I worried about that. I always thought, my goodness, I hope the father survived, or our relatives.
For my family, nobody survived. When my sister died. After the liberation.
Yes.
And my mother.
And your mother died after her.
After her?
Yes. Your sister died before your mother.
Yes.
Helen tells Elchanan about the lethal injections given by the Nazis.
I got a needle here.
And the lack of medical attention for weeks after they were liberated by the Russians.
No doctor or something that can help them?
Nobody.
You were near Reva when she died?
Yes, I was. And I watched her. There was this is the painful thing. This is the painful, and I understand how they came to pick up the body of Reva. She was put into the a horse and buggy.
My mind is
I'm sorry.
No.
They moved her away to a cemetery somewhere. And where she's buried, I don't know. I'm sorry.
The two sit in silence. Reva's brother is overwhelmed by the new information.
Helen's grandson, Andrew, has driven to a small town 2 hours south of Stutthof. He is looking for the place where Russian soldiers housed Helen and Reva after their liberation.
My grandmother described it as a school building. The archivist at Stutthof told me about this town, and this building fits the description of the school that my grandmother has told me about. So this really could be it. This could be the school that my grandmother and Reva were laying down next to each other for maybe a month, talking to each other about their little brothers and their stories, and ultimately where Reva passed away, right next to my grandmother. And I know that my grandmother has mentioned that there's a horse and buggy that picks up Reva's dead body and brings her to a cemetery. And just across the street, there is a cemetery, and it's very possible that this could be the place where Reva was brought to.
Slowly, Andrew walks through the cemetery.
I don't think that they would have given a marker to a Jewish girl in 1945 in a cemetery like this. But, I mean, if this is her resting place, I think my grandmother will take comfort in knowing that I've come here and I'm paying respect for her on her behalf.
Andrew turns away and looks into the distance of the cemetery. Then, an old photograph of Reva is shown. Cut to Helen holding the photo. She shakes her head as she looks at the photograph. Fade to black. Text reads, Maxwell.
The baby is important because the baby carries a guilt in me. Carries a terrible guilt that Yannick died because of me pulling him into that water and for nothing. And if this baby is alive, it would just clear my conscience that he didn't die for nothing. He died for something. He's a hero.
Maxwell and Natasha look at a map.
So this is the place that you mentioned in your testimony. Yeah.
Where's Buchaj?
Buchaj is...
Maxwell is meeting with Holocaust investigator Natasha Nijelska. She has spent weeks scouring maps, uncovering documents, and chasing testimonies in search of the baby that Maxwell and Yannick saved in 1943.
That was a quite a challenging task, because we didn't know at all the identity of people who were in hiding. We didn't know the name of the baby. We didn't even know whether there is a chance that this girl survived the war. We had only question marks. I tried to reconstruct what was going on in the area and try to identify the group. I found two girls that survived the war. So they were hiding also somewhere on a riverbank. One of them wrote a book with her own memories because she was 6 at the time. She recalled the description of the death of her mother. She managed to escape and cross the river, yet her mother stayed in the river with her sister.
You mean it's a possibility?
I think there is a possibility. There are some details that are really similar in your story and really match your description. That sister's testimony.
I'm telling you, I have a feeling. She's the girl.
Maxwell begins to cry.
She's the girl.
Maxwell rubs his forehead.
I feel she's the girl.
For sure she was in the same time, in the same forest. And her story is very similar to the story that you have. Would you possibly like to meet her?
Maxwell thinks.
I don't know if I can.
The two sit in silence as Maxwell thinks over his options.
She has a memory loss. And she... It's impossible to communicate with her. But her family knows. They heard that you're arriving to Israel.
It is the best news in the world that you know what it means to me that the baby is alive. It means everything to me. It means freedom. It means I'm not guilty. I did save a life. Now just imagine seeing her. Will I break down and walk away? Or will I break down and stay there?
Fade to black. Text reads, Rose.
My little brother, his name was Henrik. And he was such a lovely, beautiful young boy. And I loved him with all my heart and soul. My brother was 6 when he was taken to Sobibor.
Old footage of Nazis closing train car doors. Rose is riding in the car.
Deep in the forest of Poland, on the border of modern Belarus, Sobibor was one of the most remote and secretive of all Holocaust killing sites. It was razed to the ground by the Nazis in late 1943 to destroy any evidence. But there are remnants of the horrific war crimes committed here.
Museum manager Tomas tells Rose, This is a historic place, one of them that has not changed at all. He points to the end of the railway where the blocker is and says, "This buffer stop, trains with people used to stop in front of it. An SS man would give a speech and apologize for the inconveniences in travel. He would tell them that they would build new cities here and that they'd work in the factories for the Third Reich and they could survive the war." Then, an old photograph of Nazi soldiers at Sobibor is shown.
A rare photograph exists of Sobibor when it was operational. Dating from 1942, it shows the station where Rose's mother and younger brother disembarked from the boxcar.
Tomasz continues to speak. Valuables, personal items, were to be stored in a special kiosk.
Anything that was of value, he told them to put it away, so I guess they can take it.
He says they got receipts for that.
Ticket that the goods that they put away.
They're saying you're gonna get
it
back.
Yeah, you're gonna get it back.
Old footage of one of those kiosks filled with items.
The Nazis had no intention of giving any of it back. Instead, jewelry was melted down and clothing redistributed to Germans. The Holocaust was entirely self-financed.
Tomasz speaks again. He says, the prisoners undressed and went naked to the third camp along these trees.
So here they told them to undress and they told them to walk there.
77 years after her mother and younger brother walked this path, Rose, who is in search of what happened to them, must now do the same.
Fade to black. Text reads, Helen.
I took it upon myself to tell Riva's story, because it could have been me in reverse.
This is Riva.
Helen has finally met the little boy she's wondered about her entire life. The brother of her friend who died beside her after liberation from a concentration camp.
Yeah, Riva told me that she has a little brother that was given away to the Christians. And it made a big impression on me. She told me that because I had a young brother that was taken away from the Kinderaktie.
Your brother?
My brother, yes. I had a little brother was taken away in the Kinderaktie.
Riva's brother leans back and looks away. A chalk animation shows Helen's brother when he was taken away.
My grandmother and Riva probably thought that their brothers would not have survived the Holocaust. I think it'll be closure for my grandmother to know that Riva's little brother survived. That's going to make her incredibly grateful to have known that this boy existed, because perhaps she can see her own brother in him.
Helen and Riva were the same age. So were their little brothers. These two kids from Kovno had never met before today, but their stories are forever intertwined.
ABC.
Riva's brother smiles and wipes a tear away. Cut to Helen and Riva's brother walking in a park together. It is a sunny and beautiful day.
What it is to meet you, how can I describe it? I couldn't picture it in my wildest dreams.
I can tell you that what I feel for you. I feel for you a piece from my sister. Like I see my sister. And I'm very happy that I met you.
The two sit down at a park bench and chat. The shot slowly fades out of focus. Text reads, Rose.
Well, one thing I'm sure. The Jew of yesterday does not exist today. Nobody is going to walk and let them kill us like that. Never again. This much I know.
Rose looks very matter-of-fact. Cut back to Sobibor.
77 years ago, Rose's mother and younger brother, Henyuk, walked along a narrow path through the woods at Sobibor.
The forested area where the path used to be is shown. Thomas says the Germans called it Himmelstrasse.
Himmelstrasse, a road to heaven.
Who called it that?
The Germans.
The Germans. The Germans crew called this road, Road to Berlin.
Rose's granddaughter looks at Thomas, stunned.
Nothing now remains of the path walked by Rose's mother. It was designed deliberately to curve through the camp, so she couldn't have seen where it was leading. It was made of gravel, lined on either side with barbed wire, and was camouflaged with pine branches, hiding it from view. At the end of this path were four gas chambers.
A shot of a gas chamber comes into focus. Text reads, Sobibor gas chambers. Maximum killing rate, 1,000 deaths per hour. Total Jews murdered, 200,000.
That's a sort of a hard thing for me to think about and imagine. But I can just see her holding the child in her arms and thinking that she cheated them of one. Me.
You have to understand. If Hitler had his way, I would have died right here. And if my mother wasn't the woman that she was, with the wisdom and knowledge and love, if she wouldn't have pushed me off the road, I would have been buried with everybody here, and you would have never existed.
Rose and her granddaughters share a somber moment and reflect together. They slowly embrace one another.
I'm so glad that I brought you here. Just if my mother can know, I don't know how, that we are alive and that I have grandchildren and grandchildren and that we live through all of that. Oh my God, if there is a God, maybe she'll know.
Nine mass graves were discovered at Sobibor, which now are covered by a field of memorial stones.
Oh, my mom. My dear mom. Here hanging, a beautiful little boy that I love so much. He might have still been alive.
Rose has one last task to perform on her journey. To say Kaddish, the Hebrew prayer of mourning.
Oseh shalom bimrumav, hu yaseh shalom aleinu, v'al kol Israel, v'imru, amen.
Do you want to say their names, Bobby? Yeah.
Deborah Henye and Izzy Handelsman, who died here. Leise Handelsman, who died in Majdanek. And all my other relatives, including my grandmother Tema, and all my uncles and aunts, and all my little cousins that I loved so much, they're all gone. Let's hope the world has learned its lessons, that it should never, ever happen again.
An overhead shot of the expanse of White Stone Memorial. Fade to black. Text reads, Maxwell.
It entered my mind like in a far dream. Is it possible, really, that one day I'm going to meet her face to face, the little baby?
Maxwell is heading to Haifa in Israel to meet survivor Tova Barkai. He hasn't seen her in 76 years. She was a tiny little girl when he and his friend Yannick saved her from her dead mother's arms.
That's good, because
Tova's family doesn't know the truth about how she survived the massacre by the river.
Hello.
Hello.
May I introduce to you Maxwell Smart? This is
Oliver. I'm Oliver.
This is the descendants.
Yeah.
That's nice to see a descendant of somebody that I saved. I was always wondering what happened to your mother.
Yeah.
All my life. She wasn't a good baby, your mother. She cried all the time.
She's a survivor.
The Burkai family brings out Tova, who is in a hospital chair. Maxwell smiles wide and approaches Tova.
You recognize me?
In Yiddish.
I saved you. You was lucky. You was very lucky.
Maxwell asks if she can understand Yiddish.
Oh, she knows Yiddish, but she can't speak. She can't find the words.
Do you remember the river? How freezing the water was. How the two children, the two boys came and saved you. How they came, went into the water and took you out from the arms of your mother.
You owe him your life.
Maxwell says, I was the one who saved you from Hitler. Tova responds, that I know. Maxwell says, you were a little baby.
She knows me. She knows me.
Tova reaches out her hand and Maxwell holds it.
She's touching my hand. She's look.
Oh, yes.
She said that it will be good. Everything will be good. It's okay. She said it's okay.
I feel better. And I don't feel as guilty. It's true. Yannick died. He's a hero. He saved you, and you have children. A family. They will have children and children and children. A continuation of life forever.
Maxwell stands with Tova and her family. Shown are old photographs of Tova and her family throughout the generations. Two of the photographs are not in color, but the final one is. Cut back to Maxwell. He is laughing with Tova's family.
This is nice, Tom.
It's better to hug them.
Sure. Look at that.
He'll be seeing you.
You want to give me a hug?
Somehow, we'll be seeing you.
I'm an old man who wants to hug an old man.
Someone that owes his life to you.
Thank you very much.
Fade to black. Shown an old photograph of Yannick. Text reads, 1931 to 1943. Then, fade to black. While credits roll, text reads, Maxwell attributes his survival to a local Polish farmer, Jasko Rudnicki. He is now a successful artist in Montreal and has 3 children and 4 grandchildren. Rose survived the war by posing as a Polish laborer in Germany. She now lives in Toronto with her children, granddaughters, and great-grandchildren. Helen and her mother spent 3 years in refugee camps before immigrating to Canada. She now has 3 children, 9 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. Her son is named after her little brother, Avramail.